He picked it up out of curiosity, and the mine exploded in his hands. Both his hands were amputated at the wrists. He completely lost one of his eyes, and the other eye can only barely make out the light. These victims were all born after the war, but they have fallen victim to its heritage. Our Bob was part of a demining squad, but was maimed while trying to defuse a mine that had become extra sensitive as a result of the passage of time. The victims of mine explosions and their families need immediate medical attention and financial support after the accident. They won't be able to carry on living normal lives anymore. For instance, a child who has lost a limb needs new prosthetics as he or she grows older, as well as constant physiotherapy and psychotherapy. Halime is now receiving medical care and financial support, but nothing can make her forget the pain she has suffered. Khatun is determined to do what she loves, despite her physical and mental scars. Arbab was lucky the protective gear he was wearing saved his life, but he can't participate in the demining operation anymore, and will be supported by the mentioned network instead. Landmines have been much crueler to the children of the Dehgorji village, though. The children discovered a Volmara bouncing fragmentation mine while out playing. This type of mine detonates in two stages. The first explosion launches it about 40 to 50 centimeters off the ground, where the main charge detonates, projecting more than 1,000 fragmentations in all directions, and killing or wounding everyone within an effectable radius. 5 children were killed. For a child, the difference between knowing how to act when faced with a landmine or unexploded ordnance and not knowing how dangerous they are is literally life or death. Children are the age group most hurt by these munitions. That's why the more the number of civilians educated about them, the less the casualties. Demining operations must be supplemented with civilian education, which has a real effect on reducing deaths and the loss of limbs. The geographical dispersion, the varying lifestyles and ages of the people at risk from landmines, makes educating them a big challenge. Not to mention that most of these people are villagers, shepherds and nomads. Some of them are even travelers who just pass through these areas.
Boy, no, boy.
اگه این علامت یا این تابلو هر جا نصب بود یعنی اونجا یک منطقه خطرناکه.
The places those people need to be educated have a larger combined area than the regions that require demining. The educational materials and methods need to be adapted to the different ages and different sections of society. The Mine Action Center is responsible for the policy making, planning, and assessing the effectiveness of the education. Accordingly, the center focuses on prioritizing the different regions in need of education and producing and adapting the educational materials to match the type of threat and the target audience. The educational materials are produced in the form of documentaries, stories, or even animations in different local languages and provided to educators. Brochures, books, and pictures were also used in some areas. The demining process in Iran has one major difference with the rest of the world, and that is the limitations caused by the unjust, politically motivated sanctions, which prevent any country or international organization from collaborating with the Islamic Republic. A look at the statistics reveals that Iran hasn't received any financial aid for its humanitarian demining activities. In addition, Iran isn't given access to advanced equipment. It is even banned from using the IMSMA, the Information Management System for Mine Action, which registers information regarding the detection and clearance of mines. Put simply, Iran is barred from receiving any equipment or financial and scientific aid. Why? Because Iran is sanctioned, and therefore its demining operations are also sanctioned. After the war, the lands all along the border was unusable due to contamination. Every day, life and business in these areas were facing total destruction. More important, however, was the damage done to the public's mental sense of security. This map shows the regions of Iran's five border provinces contaminated with landmines and unexploded ordnance after the end of the war. This map shows the state of those regions after 30 years of demining. Despite all the sanctions and limitations, published statistics reveal that the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center boasts the highest number of discovered mines in 2019.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is no stranger to the work we do, and Excellency, your country has consistently supported the efforts of the General Assembly in the elaboration of resolutions on assistance in mine action and other very important disarmament resolutions.
They might have been able to impose great limitations on Iran's humanitarian demining activities through their sanctions, but nevertheless, the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center still outperforms all other countries when it comes to mine clearance, thanks to its achievements and wealth of experience.
And I think also the mix of the countries and the participants in this particular roundtable was just excellent. I mean, I must congratulate the Iranian, the IRMAC, for having done such a good choice. I can also say that, you know, we all know that Iran plays a very particular and important role in this region. And it is clear that in the future there is a very good prospect to have a stronger interaction for all of you with the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to humanitarian demining and maybe also in other aspects.
Opening the doors of the Iranian Mine Action Center, which is an institution under the Ministry of Defense, and which shows also the openness and readiness of the Islamic Republic of Iran to share and learn from partner countries. So these would be my improvised last words today.
This is the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center's International Education Building, a center for the exchange of experience, supportive research and scientific activities, and improving the knowledge and skill of mine clearance squads. This education center represents the peak of the Mine Action Center's abilities and the essence of its scientific advancements. Research projects regarding novel ways of clearing mines are always of high priority at this center. This complex isn't restricted to just Iranian squads, and students from other countries are allowed to attend the programs held here. This center strives to expand humanitarian demining efforts and help improve the mine clearance capabilities of other countries. Iran's increasing knowledge of demining has led international institutions and other countries struggling with the clearance of unexploded munitions to request to collaborate with Iran. Khuzestan Province, Darkhobain. This region had been underwater for the past years, and as the water subsided, an unbelievable scene began to emerge. Thousands of unexploded ordnance, left over from the war, were sticking out of the ground, which couldn't be seen before. Although the area had been previously cleared, this deadly munition field had expanded the contaminated area once again. Iranian lands contaminated with mines and unexploded ordnance were cut from 4,200,000 hectares to around 100,000 hectares through 30 years of demining operations. Clearing the remaining area, however, is proving more difficult than all the previous areas that had been cleared combined. This is because these lands have very special characteristics. At least 50,000 hectares are flooded, making the job similar to finding a needle in a haystack. These regions need to be demined regardless, because they can contaminate nearby safe zones and are a threat to the lives of those living there. The more advanced the weapons became, the more people died after the wars ended. As soon as one war ended, another would begin, and so the weapons never stopped firing. One thing all those wars had in common was the unexploded munitions and mines they left behind. Very little attention is paid to the deaths caused by unexploded munitions, because they happen after the war is over, and because everybody thinks the war is not going to claim any more lives now that it's over.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Through both their statements and their silence, leading European thinkers have exposed Western racism. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, En Berara is an Israeli expression that is used to depict the persistent destruction, ethnic cleansing, and now genocide of indigenous Palestinians as acts of self-defense for which there is no alternative. The International Court of Justice recently affirmed the real and imminent risk arising from South Africa's allegations that the Zionist regime is committing genocide in Gaza. This did not unfold in a vacuum. Such outcomes are inherent to the settler colonial structure of elimination imposed on Palestine by Euro-American imperialism. As detailed in South Africa's application to the ICJ, decades of Israeli colonialism led to the state reaching its genocidal moment. In 2006, Patrick Wolf, a distinguished scholar of settler colonialism, considered genocide to be plausible in Palestine. He saw compelling indications of genocidal dynamics through the Zionist regime holding the Palestinian population captive in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Although universally recognized as the crime of all crimes, genocide represents just one of many atrocious manifestations of settler colonial violence, which is leveraged to seize land and dispossess indigenous owners. There is an army of not just troops, but also philosophers, ethicists, who moralize and justify colonialism as acts of embrera, or no choice. This notion is deeply entrenched in Euro-modern colonial knowledge, which has criminalized and deprived colonized peoples of ontological resistance so that their souls, psyches, and identities can be reshaped to suit the colonizers' schemes, as Franz Fanon reminds us in Black Skin, White Masks. This mechanism of self-vindication denies colonized people the rights to self-defense and resistance to preserve and reclaim their humanity. Instead, it transfers guilt onto the victims. The Spanish conquistadors considered the deaths and calamities they inflicted on the indigenous peoples of South America as their own fault for standing in the invaders' way. Philosopher George Hegel asserted that Africans were guilty because of their innate contempt for humanity, which made them susceptible to being shot down by thousands in war with Europeans. Similarly, the Zionist regime holds Palestinians condemnable for having forced Zionist settlers to kill them, as suggested by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Golda Meir. In the 21st century, leading European thinkers associated with the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory insist on reminding us of the indivisibility of European modern ethics and coloniality. Jürgen Habermas, a prominent European philosopher, and others expressed solidarity with the Zionist regime in mid-November while genocide was clearly unfolding in Gaza. Habermas based his stance on the contrived accusation that the resistance group Hamas intends to eliminate Jewish life in general, implying that the Zionist regime had no choice but to retaliate in the manner it has. The resistance group Hamas, which is proscribed as a terrorist group in the UK and other Western regimes, has on several occasions affirmed that it does not wage a struggle against the Jews because they are Jewish, but wage a struggle against the Zionists who occupy Palestine. Other critical philosophers, including Celia Benhabib, have echoed the Zionist regime's allegations on the killings of babies, burning people alive, and ritual murder, which have been debunked as fabricated propaganda. Truth, facts, proof, objectivity, context, and history apparently have no place when Eurocolonial interests are at stake. Amid the clamor of dehumanization, Palestinians, like all colonized people, have been stripped of their rights on the ontological resistance and self-defense. Palestinian life has come into conflict with white supremacy and the West's desire to atone for its own anti-Semitism and the genocide of European Jews. Consequently, Palestinians have become the embodiment of the damned of the earth of the 21st century, literally forced out through genocide and ethnic cleansing. Both Palestinians and Jews were singled out in the statement by Habermas and his colleagues. While the latter were deemed worthy of special protection, the former was silenced and removed from the sphere of human dignity and concerns about the democratic ethos of the West. This represents two faces of the same racist and dehumanizing idea that has historically pitted supposedly inferior groups, including Jews and Muslims, designated as Semitic peoples against the self-declared superior European Aryan race. Evil might have changed its form, but not its racist essence. Palestine is the ethical battleground of our time, where the racism inherent in Euro-modern colonial knowledge is dissected, exposed, and resisted. This knowledge system, whether by justification or through silence, echoes the historical pattern of colonial atrocities across the global South, including the unfolding genocide in Palestine. In this light, as eloquently articulated by ethics professor Wael Hallaq, the Palestinian experience of colonial life and death encapsulates the global issue of ethics and knowledge. A window to Palestine.
Soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine. Hello and welcome to the program. Today we are witnessing a genocide in Palestine, but this did not start on October the 7th. It is part of a plan that was born more than 125 years ago with a perfectly studied and planned colonization process. Today we will talk about how Palestine has been changed and how the occupation has changed the life of this territory and the entire area that surrounds it. Let's analyze and have a deeper look into this issue.
Thank you.
Efectivamente, hace más de 100 años comenzaron a llegar.
Indeed, more than 100 years ago, they began to arrive as victims of the pogroms of Tsarist Russia, and years later, the Nazi Holocaust. But shortly after they were received with open arms of solidarity with their pain, they began to show their true face, to expropriate the Palestinians, to destroy their villages, to destroy their ancient olive plantations, to keep absolutely everything, destroying schools and houses and any vestige of the territory's history. Let's see below the following report by our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hejazi.
Before the aggression on the Gaza Strip on October 7th, the Israeli cabinet had approved new plans to build thousands of homes in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. According to international law, the construction of these settlements is illegal and constitutes an obstacle to peace. However, this decision occurred amid an increase in violence by settlers and the occupation army in the Palestinian territories, and this was one of the reasons that caused the Operation Al-Aqsa flood to break out.
The construction of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories and in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is an illegal, illegitimate act and condemnable. Under no circumstances can the permanence of these settlements be supported, since they do not agree with the norms of international law in general. The only solution is to put an end to these settlements.
According to Palestinian sources, this Israeli war has been one of the most brutal in history, which has caused the destruction of more than 70% of the structures in the Gaza Strip. Given this, the Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, assured that the massacre in Gaza is an opportunity to develop a project that will encourage Gazan residents to immigrate to other countries in the world. This is in addition to the solution proposed by the Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, which encourages the voluntary immigration of the citizens of Gaza and in fact depopulate the area of Palestinians.
They're trying to bomb all the places, displace people by force. They say that this is a voluntary displacement, but in reality it is not. The displacement is due to the crimes of the occupation, the deliberate and systematic bombing of civilians. They even bomb areas where the displaced people live. This is a forced displacement of citizens under armed pressure, including planes and tanks, as well as a psychological and media impact with a war waged against the Palestinian people.
The reports released by the UN indicate a very significant increase in violent incursions by Israeli settlers in the West Bank cities since October 7th. This has caused the death of a record number of Palestinians. This is also considered an integral part of the Zionist plan that seeks to completely dispossess Palestinians of their land.
The attack on Palestinian citizens in the cities of the West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, or even inside occupied Palestine is considered a crime in every sense. This is a political cost for Netanyahu's cabinet, along with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. They have decided to give the settlers the green light to do whatever they want with the objectives of invading and the Judaization that the settlers are carrying out, including the raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is actually one of the reasons that led to the outbreak of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Therefore, the cost for the cabinet of Netanyahu, who is now appeasing the settlers after giving them the green light, is very high.
There are a large number of Gazans who have decided to stay in their homes and not go out despite the great danger to their lives. However, they have decided to resist and not allow a second Nakba to take place. This is another act of resistance by the Palestinian population. It is to continue showing the world the crimes committed by the Israeli regime. A large number of journalists and media workers have been murdered for the simple fact of being eyes of the truth and reporting Israel's actions.
The way to confront this occupation is to stay alive and rebuild any place that is being destroyed. Today, every Palestinian citizen who has a mobile phone is now able to broadcast through social media and expose this occupation by spreading the truth about everything. The painful truth is that in the past month, we've seen that journalists are being attacked because they wanted to show the true image of the occupation. They've also become a target for exposing the crimes of the occupation in front of the Arab and international community.
Despite the constant crimes committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza and other Palestinian territories, the world continues to fold its arms and do nothing to stop this massacre. For 75 years, Palestinians have lived under Israeli occupation. During all these decades, it has been carrying out the most atrocious crimes against the Palestinian population. Now, again in the 21st century, and in the face of silence from the international community, the Zionists seek to expel the Gazans from their territories to take control of the rest of Palestine. Huda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
The current inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, depending on their age, have been forcibly displaced between 1 and 3 times over the last 75 years. It all began in 1897 at the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, when Theodor Herzl presented to a tiny part of the world Jewry their project to rebuild the regime of Israel from the Nile to Euphrates, the founding myth of being part of the chosen people and this being the promised land. We thank our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hejazi, and I invite you to stay tuned because in the next section we will be talking with a very special guest. Well, we are back, and in this section we are going to talk with Silvana Rabinovich, who is a researcher at the Philological Research Institute of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Thank you, Silvana, for accepting this welcome invitation. I want to ask you a question that many are asking in the current context with this ongoing genocide. At what point in this historical development of the Zionist project are we, and how far do they intend to go?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate the invitation. I'm very honored. Well, I want to mention points about the colonial and national colonial political theology of Israel. I think that from that point of view, we've reached the moment when the last apocalyptic mooring is loose. And when we talk about the Zionist project, I think we have to also take into account Christian Zionism, which is very interested in this apocalypse for the second coming of Christ. And well, I believe that there is no return to this. There was already genocide in progress there, but now we're witness to an accelerated genocide. It's been unleashed. And I'm surprised by the reception it has among the Israeli population, even those that claim to be progressive, and even among former conscientious objectors who today have decided, at age 40 and a half, for example, to enroll in this massacre, this genocide. That is extremely worrying because it's an attitude that was growing and deepening. And in this case, there really was no difference between the different administrations in Israel, whether those assumed to be left-wing, which can be discussed, or those on the right regarding the settlements. We're, of course, focused on Gaza, which is something atrocious, and it is difficult to understand why the entire world does not rise up against the genocide there. Well, some governments around the world, or rather nations, have taken actions. In other words, the siege that surprised the Israelis on October 7th is being constantly documented. That, of course, it is very scary that they will take you out of bed and arrest you. But it happens. As Haggai Matar, the director of Plus 92 magazine, said, it happens every day there. Just one letter signed by 669 Israelis in support of South Africa's claim before the International Court of Justice is all that was achieved from the entire population, considering even those who did not vote for this administration, those who took to the streets to protest against Netanyahu. That really catches my attention. They hid themselves under the cloak of what that assures them of collective suicide with what they consider the enemy.
After the first Zionist Congress in 1897, there was talk of Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. In 1948, they accepted, of course, the partition of Palestine, but declared that it was a first step. Then in 1967, in the misnamed Six-Day War, they occupied the entire Palestinian territory, and some areas of the Syrian Golan Heights and Lebanon, in where the Zionist project is going.
¿Dónde para el proyecto sionista?
A ver, el proyecto sionista, yo quisiera hacer un poquito de historia.
Let's see, the Zionist project. It goes back a little bit to history, because from the first Zionist Congress to the ones that followed, there was a lot of discussion there. And there were voices that did not agree at all with this form of foreign colonialism in the region and typically European version, nor with the fact of considering the original inhabitants of the land as enemies. I mean, in 2006, I translated Martin Buber's political text, and there was a whole movement, a movement that was against it. Let's see, in 1946, when the Anglo-American Commission went to Palestine to see if the land was actually divided or not, which was carried out on November the 29th, 1947, they disobeyed the leadership of the Jewish population of Palestine. Martin Buber, Yehuda Magnus, and Moshe Slimansky. They all arrived and convinced the Anglo-American Commission that the land should not be divided, that there should be neither one nor two national states, but a confederation of autonomous communities from the part of Greater Syria. So within the Zionist movement, there were also these positions which were all the time denouncing the demographic and expansionist ideas as deeply contradictory with the love of the land, with the possibilities of coexistence that existed. However, well, we see now that not a bit of that remains. That was present until 1948. And all the years that Martin Buber was still alive, Martin Buber continued fighting to protect, to protest the properties, the rights of the Palestinian population. Of course, he died in 1965. He no longer saw 1967. He did not see all that expansionist fever, absolutely foreign to the culture of the region. I would also like to point to the time of the secularization of the Hebrew language. Yehuda proposed and practiced this secularization of the language, which was much discussed due to the connotations it later had, which we are seeing now in its worst moment and in its worst version. He said that the words that had to be completed from so many countries, that the Hebrew language had to be confined to the ritual religious sphere, had to be completed from Arabic, which was the closest language, the most sisterly, and the one of the place. But well, the Zionist leadership is doubly Eurocentric. It is Eurocentric in Central Europe, and it used the Jews of Arab countries as human shields to carry out this project, which, as Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, said, had to have its function be the retaining wall that prevents Eastern barbarism from entering Europe. And well, this is what we're seeing now, and it is in its worst phase, of course.
Y está en su peor fase, por supuesto.
Gracias, Silvana.
Thank you, Silvana. Now I'm going to give way to the audience. They have two questions they want to ask you. Please.
Por favor.
Hola, mi nombre es Jangeria.
Hello, my name is Jangeria. I am a philosophy professor, also of Palestinian descent in Chile. I wanted to ask you the following question. I wanted to know what you think about the biblical names that the Israelis use for both the use of weapons and also the military campaigns that they carry out, precisely in a land that we know has that connotation.
Gracias, Hani. Eso es justamente el tema que yo más trabajo.
Thanks. That is precisely the topic that I work on the most. I mean, the abusive ways in which the biblical text and biblical figures are used to name these campaigns, weapons. And well, it has a purpose that Netanyahu recently reminded us of when he spoke of Amalek, which is that people who must be exterminated, according to God, for having abused the weakest at the exit from Egypt. Something that one says now. Well, the one who is playing the role of Amalek is the Netanyahu administration, and not the people of Gaza whom he's trying to annihilate. This happens in Rafael Industries. What's happening? From the name Rafael, since it is actually an acronym to each of the names of the campaign. I've detailed this in my book, The Drone Bible, about such abuses and the abuses of biblical figures in Israel's political discourse. I believe that in the Bible, there are two sources. One is monarchical and the other one is prophetic.
The prophetic sets limit to the monarchic. Obviously, the one that prevails is the monarchic in a European sovereignist version. And what it seems to me is that the Bible is needed precisely to evoke the limiting forces that the prophetic sources set.
The limit que ponía la fuente profética.
Hola.
Hello, my name is Carmen Mendoza. I am an international journalist, and I would like to know who are the settlers, where do they come from, and what role have they played and are playing in the occupation of Palestine?
Gracias por la pregunta, Carmen. A ver, los colonos.
Thanks for the question, Carmen. Let's see. The settlers, many of them, are Zionist immigrants, very convinced of this expansionist vision that Daniel described at the beginning. They tend to come from the United States and France and also other places. There are, of course, Israelis born there, of course, but it is striking how there are people who have immigrated to occupy the land, to radically carry out this ethnic cleansing to the point of genocide, and which is also manifested in the siege. There are Israeli organizations that seek to protect the settlers, especially Area C. But the truth is that Area A, similar to Area B and Area C, are constantly besieged by the army. On June the 8th, 50 armored cars poured into Ramallah just to destroy the apartment of someone who was there in jail in Israel in Area A. So this form of presence is what they call showing presence. It makes the settlers feel completely free to commit all kinds of crimes. Even the last administration has greatly encouraged them to be armed with heavy weapons. Even teenagers who go to school armed with heavy weapons. So let's say there is a debasement, a civil debasement at the beginning. Now, deepening of this debasement is enormous, and they are very convinced settlers and young people. I went to the Jordan Valley accompanying a group of Israeli retirees who defend the shepherds so that they can graze. What happened was that two young boys of about 16 years old went down with their cows to destroy the wheat fields with their tiny tractors to scare the sheep. In other words, there is a siege. There is a constant siege, and there are, of course, young people born there, but also very right-wing, as well as convinced Zionists who emigrate to precisely what they call badly, very badly, Judaize the land. This is what we see in the Jerusalem area, the Greater Jerusalem Project, right? But we shouldn't also forget about what's happening in the worst of the lowest in Hebron, which is Al-Khalil.
La peor de las más bajas en Hebrón, que es Al-Khalil.
Muchas gracias, Silvana.
Thank you very much, Silvana, for accepting our invitation. What you say is absolutely true. Here in Chile, there is a Hebrew Institute that in one of its last years makes study trips to the occupied territories, and there they do a course of almost a week called GUTNA, where they teach Chilean citizens how to use weapons wearing Israeli army uniform. And that, incredibly, is legal. I thank you very much for your participation, and let's take a break.
Y vamos a una pausa, ya regresamos.
Dear listeners, that was the first part of A Window to Palestine. You can listen to the second part tomorrow.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamati.
Islamati.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all. Love time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station, Choo Choo Kachu. It's Youth Station for you. I'm your humble co-host, Muzaffar Haider.
And I am Asma.
How are you doing, Sister Asma?
Well, it's fine. Well, we're having a lot to talk about.
Yeah?
Yes.
What have you been up to? It's Ramadan, so we're like...
Yes, of course, but then still life is an ongoing process, so we have to think about everything, especially in Ramadan.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it happens to you as well or not, but sometimes it happened to me to think about this very point that why are we as human beings do not get satisfied with anything, like in hardships, when everything, when the hustles and bustles are done and we're over it, and like you are past all of these difficulties, then there comes this peaceful condition. And then in those peaceful condition, again, you feel like you need some suspense in your life, some more of adventure, some more of excitement. You're not satisfied with anything.
You're asking the wrong person. I go through that every day. I wonder to myself, what am I doing at home or at work or whatever other mundane activity I'm partaking in? And I'm thinking, why am I not off on an adventure on a ship or fighting with pirates or, you know, battlefield somewhere? Yes. You know, where's the adventure in my life?
So, but do you think about the aftermath of that adventure? Like when you are put in that adventurous situation, would you be satisfied with it? Or no, you would feel like, okay, I want to be back at home. I want my peaceful.
That's a good question. Yeah, I probably want to be back at home.
Yeah.
It's that old saying, isn't it? The grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't matter where you are. You're always going to see something else as greater. And that's why satisfaction with Allah is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have that satisfaction with Allah, once you have that, you know, sense of tranquility and thankfulness for whatever situation you are in, that's when your life will actually progress. Until then, you're always going to be in this state of dissatisfaction.
Yeah, there is this paradoxical feeling in us as human beings. Like, just as I said, when it's war, we want the peace. When it's peace, we want the war.
Yeah.
Like, as I am just saying, it's so paradoxical and sometimes it's so annoying to think about it.
In movies and stories, they always show that they often show that the character is, the main character, the protagonist, who is probably, they're always depicted in a state of satisfaction, and then that satisfaction is snatched from them, and they have to join. Like, for example, it'll be a farmer or something, and he's really happy, he's got a wife and kids.
And then there's a quest, they have to go for that quest.
Exactly.
And then life changes, and then again, we come to the moment of equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, that cycle has to be broken.
Yep, yep.
Every now and then.
It's the whole narrative theory behind it is, I feel like when you study narrative theory, because we're both English literature students, right? It's really fascinating because people don't realize this. They think, it's not just stories. When we're studying narrative theory, we're actually studying the theory of life itself.
Exactly.
And there is a reality behind what we are reading in the novel and what is reflected in the outside world, what we're actually experiencing. So, for example, one of the things that we learn in narrative theory is the thing that you just pointed out, that there's always an equilibrium, then a disruption of that equilibrium, and then a new equilibrium is established.
Exactly.
And it's always like that. Now, even if you just zoom out and look at our existence, that is the case, because you're going to be born into this world and then you're tested, right? The disruption of the equilibrium takes place. And then eventually, you know, in the hereafter, you're going to get a new equilibrium, a new existence.
Exactly.
And that is going to reflect what you've done throughout this journey of life. So it's really profound in that sense, and I really love to think about it. And a lot of the ways that I understand life, the universe, and everything is that we're simply players. You know, as Shakespeare said, that the world's a stage and we are but the players. We really are just characters in this epic story being written by the greatest of creators, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly, yeah. That's why I love literature. It actually reflects us,
Every single individual who's living in this world has been reflected in all those books, among those papers and words. So just as you mentioned, all the stories, they either start from the equilibrium that has to be disrupted, or they're going to start from disruption that are going to end in equilibrium. So as we have it in the Holy Book of Quran as well, innama al-usra yusra, after all difficulties, there is this tranquility and there is this peaceful moment that you're going to achieve. So it's both hopeful, and at the same time, sometimes when you get to that peaceful condition of your life, maybe it will turn you into a different person, like you would get used to this silence and this peace, which is not always good. So we have to go for a break, and then after we come back, we'd pursue our discussion.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yes, you're listening to Youth Station, and we're talking about why us as human beings do not get satisfied with anything. Like, whenever it is equilibrium, we're just searching for a disruption. Whenever it's disruption, we're searching for an equilibrium. So we're kind of paradoxical in what we want.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of life, I suppose. Let's just bring an example from the ordinary life. Like, whenever you have too much of works to be done at your workplace, or whenever you have a lot of courses to study for your exams, after that hard times are over, then you feel like you're missing all those fightings, all those wars and conflicts. But then when you're back to those conflicts, you feel like, okay, how much I miss my comfort zone. I would love to go back.
It's, for example, age as well, right? However, once you pass the age of 30, right, you start to look back and you're like, I wish I was 25, or I wish I was 26, wish I was 27. But the reality is that, I don't know, I looked it up, and apparently people are always want to be a certain age, and that certain age, can you guess what it is? When they ask older people, which age would you like to be?
No, I'm personally, myself, I always miss my childhood.
Really? Well, they say it's 36. 36 is like that idea. I know, it's so strange, isn't it? I don't know. Well, I guess we'll know once we get there, but inshallah. But yeah, so it's always about this discontent with where we are. And that's where a lot of this inner peace, you know, Islam is all about that peace, right? It's not just peace in the general sense, like, you know, is it, oh, it's a peaceful religion. No, it's not just talking about that. It's about acquiring this inner tranquility, this satisfaction with the decree of Allah. It's absolute submission to the will of Allah.
And it's not, how is it achieved? Now, that's the question.
Yeah, that's the exact question. But it's about, you know, complete, it's not just submission as in my actions are submitted to Allah, but my heart is submitted as well. And that's why you have a personality like Imam Ridha alayhi salam, who's completely, his name means the satisfied. He's in acceptance of what's happening in his life. He understands fully and completely that this is the will of Allah.
Yeah, and contentment.
It's complete contentment.
The last key, I guess, in our lives. Like, we're not content with anything that happens to us and with anything that we have. There's nothing that would make us feel like, okay, this is the absolute contentment that I must have in my life.
I mean, look at the story of Prophet Ayyub, right? Prophet Ayyub was a really thankful servant of Allah. Shaitan says to Allah, well, of course he's thankful, of course he's worshipping you, because he's got everything. He's got a wife, he's got kids, he's got crops, he's got a farm, he's got respect. Let me be in control of his life. And then we'll see if he really still stays a true servant. So Allah agrees. Shaitan takes control of Ayyub's life, alayhi salam. And what Shaitan does is he kills Ayyub's, he doesn't like himself do it, but the point is that Ayyub loses his wife, he loses
everything,
his kids, he loses his crops,
him.
He loses his health, he becomes very, very sick. And even when he is absolutely sick, and this hadith is actually, you know, it's debated, but I still want to state it because it still, you know, hints at that complete ridaya, that complete satisfaction. He was so ill that he had worms on his body.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, he never prayed for health. He never prayed for whatever befell him. He was thankful for it. He was like, Alhamdulillah, Allah, this is your test, and I fully accept it. But there came a point where his people actually came to him and said, we doubt your prophethood. How can you be the prophet if you're, you know,
you're suffering this much?
At this point, Ayyub, out of the mercy of Allah, he says, oh Allah, my people are actually going to go astray. Please restore my blessings to me. And at that point, all of his blessings are restored to him.
The miracles.
Yeah, he got his children back, his wife back, his crops back, his mm-hmm. health back, and everything else. Imagine if we could train ourselves to be really thankful for whatever situation we're actually in. Like right now, I'm sitting opposite you. I could be thinking, well, why can't I be having a coffee or sitting at home playing a video game with, I don't know,
your favorite,
some kind of food.
Your favorite thing to do.
Yeah. It's like Ramadan is such a perfect analogy for this entire thing because the whole day you're thinking, what's your favorite food?
My favorite food, it depends on my mood.
I knew you were going to give some sort of answer like that. Anyway, my favorite food is spaghetti bolognese, right?
Mm.
And I could spend all day just waiting for spaghetti bolognese. But when you actually get to iftar time, you can have like two bites and you're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're thinking, oh, now I just feel stuffed and I want to go and lie down. You're never really satisfied. I think I'm most satisfied when I'm sleeping.
That's the nature of life, I guess.
The Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he said something beautiful. He said, if you doubt that you are going to die, mm-hmm. try to stay awake. As much as you try, you're eventually going to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, if you doubt that you're going to be raised again on the Day of Judgment, try to stay asleep.
Nice.
No matter how much you try and stay asleep, eventually you're going to be woken up again, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the nature of our life. There are certain things which are completely inevitable. And we're not supposed to hasten those things either, like the Day of Judgment. We should recognize that, yeah, this is a reality that's going to take place. Yeah. And it will take place whenever Allah wants it to. We're not supposed to hasten that. It's not like the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, which we're supposed to, you know, actively try and hasten.
So, if I just want to wrap it all up and give the gist of whatever we've been talking about, as in today's episode, I would say that there is no moment of satisfaction, of absolute and perfect satisfaction in our lives as long as we are in this mundane world. Like, it's a world of tests and conflict and sometimes miserable situations, but still life has got its own beauties. Like, yes, it's true that whenever it's peaceful, we're searching for the conflicts to flourish more of ourselves, to have more fruits from our lives. And whenever we are out of storms, we just miss those storms.
Mm.
Like, this is the gist of what we're talking about. And this is the nature of life, of course. So thank you, brother. And thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And it comes out to be fruitful for you guys to think more about what's going on in our lives. So this was all for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian.